From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Hurting prisoners isn't torture if the pain is only fleeting, says an August 2002 Justice Department memo. It's not torture if the soldier in question believed he was following, quote, superior orders, says a March 2003 Defense Department draft memo. U.S. and international prohibitions against torture don't apply to the president, says the same memo, because the commander-in-chief has the authority to take any steps necessary to protect national security. Last week, these explosive arguments surfaced in a series of memos leaked to the press, creating a picture of an administration working the outer limits of the law and maybe flouting those limits. In a post-9/11 world, tonight on Point, torture in the war on terror and a White House accused of putting itself above the law. We begin in Washington with Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine and author of an article in this week's issue entitled A Tortured Debate. Michael Hirsch, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So take us into this. You write that behind all of this was a long-running battle over interrogation tactics inside the administration, that battle has in effect led to this sudden gusher of leaked memos.
That's right. I think after 9/11, there were very, very intense debates, indeed debates that were never really resolved over how far you can go with interrogation. The memos that you cited and that we're reading about were really efforts to push the envelope, to allow for interrogation techniques that hadn't been used previously, and that, in fact, a lot of people in the military and the FBI were not happy about it. And one of the reasons the story, you know, continues on the way it has 2 months after the Abu Ghraib abuses were exposed,
yeah,
is that you have a lot of dissenters who are leaking these memos.
So what were the battling caps? What are they, Michael Hirsch? How do things line up here in the administration?
Well, what happened after 9/11 was that the traditional FBI sort of law enforcement approach to dealing with al-Qaeda was effectively dropped, and the CIA was authorized by the president to take new and harsher tactics. And many of the discussions that I just referred to were over specific detainees and specific kinds of interrogation techniques. So the August 2002 memo that you referred to at the outset was inspired by the capture of Abu Zubaydah, who was a top al-Qaeda official captured during the war in Afghanistan, or rather right after it, and who had stopped cooperating. And so in the White House, the Bush's, the president's legal counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, the vice president's counsel, the general counsel for the Defense Department, sat down and had a discussion, what can we do? And they discussed specific techniques, among them, for example, mock burial, which is to threaten someone with burial,
alive.
Being buried alive, but mm-hmm. not actually to do it. A technique called waterboarding, where you place a cloth over someone's face who's lying supine and you drip water into it to give them the sensation of drowning. All basically coercive techniques to try to soften up and break down resistant detainees from al-Qaeda.
So the memos that came out last week, Justice Department, Defense Department memos, how do they relate to the law, to international law, to American law, to military regulation, Michael Hirsch?
Well, there are very, very few lawyers who, having read these memos, either the two main memos that we were referring to, one in August 2002 was drafted by the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, and then another one in March 2003 drafted a working group in the Defense Department and based to a large extent on the earlier legal reasoning in the Justice memo.
Yeah.
And basically what these do is argue they provide the readers with a means of defense for some of these very, very robust, let's say, techniques. They argue that the only way something can be defined as torture, for example, is if it inflicts severe pain, and that's the intentional, that is the specific intent of the interrogator, if it causes permanent damage to the detainee, and anything short of that, the memos argue, is effectively allowable or defensible under international law. Many lawyers who have read these memos say, you know, no way that this, you know, this violates any number of conventions, including Geneva and the Convention Against Torture.
So they made the case that this is all right.
Right.
Lawyers read it and say, gee, how did you come to that conclusion?
Many lawyers who've read these memos say the reasoning is way over the top. It's not supported by precedent. For example, there's a long disquisition on the president's powers, which you also referred to at the start of the program. And people are astonished at some of this reasoning. I mean, it's effectively arguing almost the divine right of kings. A few people said to me, I thought we'd resolve these issues at Runnymede during, the Magna Carta, when, the King John had more restrictions on his power than it appears some of these lawyers are arguing for President Bush. And lawyers will tell you that in fact, the precedent cited are not apt, that they ignore other precedents, and that no president, even in time of war, can claim the kind of powers that are claimed in these memos.
Last week, both Attorney General John Ashcroft and President Bush appeared in public in different settings and were both pushed on these issues. Did they respond to the meat of the critique that's coming in reply to these memos now?
No, they seem to be just basically stonewalling. The remarkable thing about Ashcroft's appearance before the Judiciary Committee, for example, was that he simply refused to hand over this memo. He didn't offer any legal grounds, really, that are defensible. He just said he wasn't going to do it.
Even though it's practically everywhere now.
Well, that's the problem is that the Washington Post, which first disclosed this August 2002 memo, has now posted it on its website, and so it is out there. That's the problem the administration has, is this stuff is leaking out. And it's leaking out, I think, because, as we said, there was a lot of debate and a lot of dissension within the administration, particularly by lawyers in the State Department, by military lawyers and the uniformed services, who were very unhappy about what they saw as a breach of traditional military ethics, which do not allow this. I mean, there are very, very strict ethics under the Uniform Code of Military Justice about the kinds of techniques you can use. And I think that the problem the administration faces is that there are a lot of people within the military who are coming out and talking about this now.
And, of course, President Bush, questioned at a press conference last week, simply repeated that he acted within the bounds of the law. Michael Hirsch, how clear is it how close to the president these memos and this debate came, how aware of this debate the president is or was?
We really don't know whether the president was aware of any of these specifics. There's no evidence about that. What we do know is that the administration's case, first the case that the Abu Ghraib abuses that we saw in the photos were simply the work of a few MPs, and second its case that the that these memos were just abstract legal reasoning that had nothing to do with reality, they're just not holding up. I mean, first we've seen Condoleezza Rice has admitted privately, as the president's national security advisor, that the abuses were much more systemic. And we reported this week in Newsweek that in fact this memo that we're now discussing was devised in response to what to do about a specific uncooperative detainee, Abu Zubaydah, whose cooperation was deemed to be in the highest national interest, and that, in fact, conversations occurred in the White House office of Alberto Gonzalez, the president's own lawyer, about this detainee and about this memo, in which specific interrogation techniques were discussed. So I think it simply does not stand up the idea that this was just completely distant from what the president and his administration were intending. That being said, I will say that we simply do not know. President and Condoleezza Rice say that they were not aware of these discussions or these memos, and we don't have any evidence otherwise.
But the debate and the decisions that came out of it did flow, as you described there, right through the White House. Michael Hirsch, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
I was happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
Michael Hirsch is senior editor at Newsweek. He spoke with me from Washington. Last week, the watchdog group Human Rights Watch released a new report called The Road to Abu Ghraib, arguing that the abuses of detainees at the Iraqi prison were rooted in explicit White House policy. In the wake of September 11th, the report charges the Bush administration created the climate for Abu Ghraib by effectively reconceiving the Geneva Convention to allow the harsh treatment of detainees. Once the White House had put its stamp of approval on such behavior, the report argues it is, quote, not surprising that ordinary soldiers came to believe that even more extreme forms of abuse were acceptable. Tonight on Point, the law, torture, and the president's men and women Do we have a constitutional crisis here, a presidency that's put itself above the law? Or does the threat of terror justify extreme measures when sanctioned by the White House? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll hear the legal argument in a moment. But first, joining me from Brooklyn, New York, is Reed Brody, author of the Human Rights Watch report, The Road to Abu Ghraib. Good evening and welcome, Reed Brody.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You come to some pretty tough conclusions here. Describe your bottom line in this issue of policymaking around torture, Reed Brody.
Well, the bottom line is that the abuse we saw in Abu Ghraib didn't result from the acts of individual soldiers who broke the rules. It resulted from decisions by the Bush administration to cast those rules aside. And we look at it in three I think that happened in three fundamental ways. First, as you said earlier, after the September 11th attacks, the Bush administration looked at how it could evade the restraints of international law. There was President Bush's former counterterrorism chief said, after 9/11, the gloves came off. Over the objections of the State Department, over the objections of the uniformed military, which has a great attachment to the Geneva Conventions, senior administration lawyers, including the counsel to the president, Alberto Gonzalez, declared that the war against terrorism rendered obsolete the Geneva Conventions and the restrictions on the interrogation of detainees. We then saw, and this has gotten a lot less publicity. We then saw the U.S. Creating these offshore, off-limits prisons. Guantanamo Bay is well known, but there are other around the world now. There are a number of detainees who have effectively disappeared, people who have been captured by the United States and who we don't know where they are. They're being held in undisclosed locations. We see that over the last 2 years, a number of tactics have been approved to soften up detainees. Things that like hooding, keeping people in stressful positions for prolonged period, using extremes of heat and cold.
The things we all know about now.
And then for 2 years, until the publication of the photographs in Abu Ghraib, the Bush administration essentially took a see no evil, hear no evil approach as reports of abuse for the last 2 years mounted up.
And we continue to hear about new reports of abuse that got to high officers early on. But let me ask you this, Reboard, because our time is limited. The memos that we saw last week, do these constitute the smoking gun? What do you make of the argument that the memos were simply exploring the parameters of what's acceptable under international domestic law?
To me, actually, of all the things that constitute a smoking gun, it's the revelation this weekend that General Sanchez, the highest-ranking military officer in Iraq, actually approved for use in Abu Ghraib and in Iraq techniques like the use of attack dogs to instill fear, that constitute inhumane treatment in violation of the Geneva Convention. So first we have these discussions in these memos we're talking about that the administration can say, well, we never approved them. But then we have the commander-in-chief, the commander in Iraq saying, yes, you can go ahead and commit essentially war crimes. And then we have those very same war crimes being committed in Abu Ghraib, and we have the photographs of them. So I would say when you put these pieces together, there is a very bright line between these policy options that are being discussed, the way they were implemented on the ground by generals, and the torture and abuse that we saw at Abu Ghraib, and by the way, many other places, including Afghanistan and other prisons in Iraq.
And you follow that line right to the top. Reed Brody, please stick with us. Reed Brody is special counsel with Human Rights Watch. We've got much more to come. We're looking tonight at torture in the war on terror and a White House accused of putting itself above the law. How high does responsibility for Abu Ghraib go? Do we have a constitutional crisis here, a presidency that puts itself above the law, or something else? We're 1-800-423-8255. 800-259-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about torture in the war on terror and a White House accused of putting itself above the law. You can join our conversation tonight. Do we have a constitutional crisis here, a presidency that puts itself above the law, or does the war on terror, the threat of terror, justify extreme measures, whatever they may be, if the White House says we've got to do it? Let's listen for just a moment to a clip from President Bush speaking about the United States' treatment of detainees at last Thursday's press conference at the G8 summit.
The instructions went out to our people to adhere to law. That ought to comfort you. We're a nation of law. We adhere to laws. We have laws on the books. You might look at those laws, and that might provide comfort for you. And those were the instructions out of from me to the government.
President Bush at the G8 press conference last week, we are a nation of law. We're joined tonight from Brooklyn, New York, by Reed Brody, special counsel with Human Rights Watch. He wrote the Human Rights Watch report, The Road to Abu Ghraib, that came out last week. We're joined now from Washington by Walter Dellinger, head of the appellate practice at O'Melveny and Myers. He's professor at Duke University Law School. He was acting solicitor general from 96 to 97, head of the Office of Legal Counsel from 1993 to 1996. Walter Dellinger, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So you hear it right from the president's mouth there. We are a nation of laws. We adhere to laws. Is that how it looks to you in this last week as these memos have come out with the backdrop of what we've seen out of Abu Ghraib, Walter Dellinger?
Well, I think the problem we have is that the first that the president said, we will abide by the law, but his attorney general refused to release the memorandum that said what their understanding of the law was, so that gave us no sense as citizens of what the law was that they were going to be adhering to. Now that we have seen the memo, which was released today by the Washington Post, the memorandum by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel that is authorized to make binding legal determinations for the executive branch, now that we've seen that memorandum, I think it's incumbent upon the president to say that he did not mean to imply that all that the Office of Legal Counsel has found to be lawful are activities that we would condone or participate in, because the Office of Legal Counsel memo, rightly or wrongly, and we can discuss that, makes it clear that we are legally free, the government is legally free, to engage in conduct that is cruel, inhumane, and degrading, which does not reach, in their view, the level of torture, that torture is narrowly defined, and there are arguments for their position on the narrow definition of torture.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, that the president can override even the restraints on torture, and that anyone acting pursuant to his command is therefore acting lawfully, so that at the end of the day, the president's notion that we're going to abide by the law standing alone is far from comforting, because it raises the distressing notion that by his silence he has failed to give the direction to people under his command around the world that which the Office of Legal Counsel has determined may well be lawful is not indeed acceptable. And we can talk about what they deem to be lawful.
But first, Walter Dellinger, if you'd be good enough, this is not just a draft memo. This is the office that you, for several years, headed. This is a signed memorandum that has significant implications for U.S. government behavior, does it not?
Yes, indeed. In fact, this is a final signed memorandum by the head of the office dated August 2nd, 2002, and as I said, not available to the public until today. And in an earlier memorandum to the president, the White House counsel correctly noted that the Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice is the, as he said, the OLC's interpretation. OLC is the shorthand for Office of Legal Counsel.
Yes.
OLC's determination of interpretation of a legal issue is definitive. The Attorney General is charged by statute with interpreting the law for the executive branch, and that role has been delegated to the Office of Legal Counsel. So this is an authoritative view of the law by the Office of Legal Counsel.
So when you see the details there, and you hear what the president's saying, is the president within on reasonable ground when he says, I'm simply following the law, or is he endorsing a policy that, in substance, at root, is at odds with the law?
I think that's in a sense a false dichotomy, and the answer is I think somewhat more disturbing even than that would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume for the moment that the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum is correct in its interpretation of what the law is.
As disputed as that may be, we'll assume.
As disputed as that may be, I'm just assuming for a moment that that's correct.
Yep.
That view of the law includes the proposition that it is not unlawful to engage in conduct that is, quote, cruel, inhumane, and degrading.
Mm.
That even that which goes beyond cruel, inhumane, and degrading may be engaged in if the president has authorized it, because he's not, in their view, limited by the law when he's acting as commander-in-chief. And therefore, you're left with the notion that what is legal, again, accepting their view is, for the moment, is correct,
yes,
that what is legal allows treatment that is cruel, inhumane, and degrading, and may, in certain instances, include that which goes beyond it to the severest infliction akin to the pain accompanying organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or death.
Yeah.
And if that's right, what the president is saying when he's asked the question, do you engage in torture, the fact that he limits his answer to saying, all you need to know is that we're going to abide by the law. And knowing now that this is what he takes the law to be, it cries out for the president to say, but would you not renounce much of what the Office of Legal Counsel has concluded is legal, and say we're not going to do that.
And that he has not done.
That he has not done. For example, the Convention Against Torture, Article 16, says that while that which is cruel, inhumane, and degrading falls short of torture and is not criminally prohibited, nonetheless, nations should take efforts to prevent cruel, inhumane, and degrading efforts. Well, the president has nothing in the memorandum suggests that they have taken any steps to avoid or prevent that. So there's almost the negative pregnant, the horrible silence is that you have a view of what the law permits, which includes that which they themselves describe as cruel, inhumane, and degrading. The president saying, look, we're going to abide by the law, and not saying what that would suggest, which is the law allows us to engage in cruel, inhumane, and degrading efforts, and the law also allows us to engage in torture that goes beyond that to the most extreme infliction.
Not distancing
and
himself.
And we're going to abide by that, and not to say what whether, if that's your view of the law, shouldn't you be, as president, directing that activities, even though lawful by OLC's definition, should nonetheless be avoided?
Walter Dillinger, Reed Brody, stand by for just a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Falls Church, Virginia, David Rifkin. He is a partner at Baker & Hostetler. Rifkin served in the White House Counsel's Office and at the Department of Justice and Energy under Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Good evening and welcome, David Rifkin.
Good evening.
So we're trying to interpret exactly where we are here in relation to the law and the White House, in the White House, in relation to what we've seen at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. And we're hearing a picture painted of a White House which, if it doesn't see itself above the law, is willing to interpret the law in a way that we've got several guests tonight are having trouble following. Do you see the White House as legally justified, David Rifkin, in the Bush administration, in the directives that have gone out, in the guidance that's been given from the Office of Legal Counsel and more, in this whole issue of prisoner treatment and abuse?
I understand. And let me say a couple of things, and I listened very carefully to what Walter described, and I agree with much of it, but not everything. First of all, this is only a part of a very complex narrative. What we're looking at is a couple of memos that were done in an effort to answer a question of what are the outer parameters of what's legally permissible. The OLC memo signed by Jay Bybee didn't even do that much. It looked at what is legally permissible under one particular statute. As Walter knows very well from his experience in the government, it is quite common for OLC, Department of Justice, to answer such narrow questions.
But as we heard earlier, this was not into a vacuum. This was into the heart of a debate between FBI and CIA over what do we do right now.
Okay, one of the comforting things is that the administration, in the form of letters, providing information to Congress, not under oath, but nevertheless, you know, in full candor, forthcoming and entirely true, from Jim Haines, the General Counsel of the Department of Defense, which indicated that, of course, not only we're not committing torture, we're treating people humanely. I happen to think that as a matter of policy, the options that are available to people in our position are not only we should not commit torture. That's off the table. That's not even debatable.
But is it really off the table?
Inhumane treatment. And administration, to reassure Walter and others, administration has said unambiguously in response to several questions from the House and the Senate members, we're not engaging in inhumane treatment. The problem of the critics is they mix together all sorts of different things. The undeniable abuses committed by individuals at Abu Ghraib, issues relating to jurisdiction or lack thereof of Guantanamo, legal question about what the law provides, and policy questions as to what administration has done. I would be prepared to argue there's nothing that the administration has indicated as a matter of policy that suggests that it is interested in using torture and inhumane treatment. Absolutely nothing.
Reed Brody at
Can I just raise a quick question?
Is this Reed Brody?
Yeah, no, I
sorry.
You know, the administration may be saying, this is Reed Brody, that they're not engaged in inhumane treatment. But the leading general in Iraq, General Sanchez, authorized his interrogators, the interrogators in Iraq, to use military dogs to instill fear in prisoners. Now, that is inhumane treatment in violation of the Geneva Convention.
You cannot talk about these matters in gross. You cannot talk about those matters at high-level generality. And that's, frankly, a problem that I have with a lot of his criticism. I have read
A general permitting the use of dogs to scare doesn't sound generality.
If I may.
Yes.
If I may. I have seen the OLC memo. I have read the DOD memo or report very carefully. I have not seen General Sanchez's directive. It was reported in the Post.
Yes.
The Post talks about use of dogs. We did not know the context, and the military is very careful about those things, which the use of dogs was authorized. To state the obvious, even as the use of dogs, for example, in a context, as I think was done in one of the pictures in Abu Ghraib, and there would be clearly an abuse and a crime. We have a defenseless detainee crouching and the dog lunging at him. That indeed would be a crime. If you're talking about the use of dogs as the normal part of the guard detail, which uses dogs as well as other instruments to make sure that nobody escapes, and if the only use of dogs General Sanchez is talking about, for example, dogs, you know, snarling at a considerable distance away from the detainees, with all due respect, it's not inhumane treatment at all.
Well, Walter Dellinger,
how the dogs were used. Mm. That's why details are very, very important here.
Granted, Walter Dellinger, David Rifkin describes this as a complex narrative, but is it this complex? We've seen the photographs, we're hearing the reports from people in the field, and we've got the memos in front of us.
But forgive me, but photographs are uses by individuals and perhaps some of their superior officers. That's not a matter of administration.
Understood.
Policy.
Nevertheless, Walter Dellinger, do you see this as that complex or is this obfuscation?
I do think that David Rifkin's David's observation is actually very well taken, and all of us who deal with this ought to realize that it's very easy to conflate conflate abuses you see that may violate the law with let me put the best light on an Office of Legal Counsel memorandum where they're asked what is the liability under the for criminal prosecution under 18 U.S.C. 2340 and 2340A, the Torture Act, and they are sort of making a legal analysis of that narrow issue. And I think that you have to see those things in their complexity. But I really have a question for David that is not David is not rhetorical. It is you say that that the administration has told Congress that we're going to engage in humane treatment, and you and I may agree that Office of Legal Counsel memorandums probably ought not be made public. But the fact of the matter is, There's now a public memorandum out there that says that the law that we have consulted allows, you know, is not violated by actions that are cruel, inhumane, and degrading. And indeed, the president may authorize worse than that. But mm-hmm. but let's just stay with the cruel, inhumane, and degrading is lawful. And let's assume that we're not disputing whether that's right or wrong. It's a legal analysis. That is now out there in the world. It has been published on the Washington Post website. And the president says, all you need to know is that we're acting in conformity with the law. What I'm worried about is people with enforcement authority and custodial authority, you know, all over the world.
Okay,
now
here we go.
Now learning what the narrow definition of lawful and unlawful is, and the president saying we're acting lawfully. If I'm a station chief in some country, I'm thinking the president seems to have green-lighted cruel, inhumane, degrading, and possibly in some circumstances torture that goes beyond that by responding in its entirety by saying we're following the law when we now know this is what the law is.
That's a reason.
The president has some obligation to come forward now and say, you've now all read, I regret that mm-hmm. memo was made public, but now the world has seen it, and I want you to know that just because OLC says that under the narrow definition we could, without incurring criminal liability, engage in all these activities, that that's not what I meant. I didn't mean to suggest that I am approving of that, which is
David Rifkin, do we need a clarification to keep the president of the United States from appearing to bless torture?
I think so. That's a question.
I agree, and I firmly believe, and I agree with Walter, that whatever ordinary imperatives govern recommend non-disclosure of confidential legal advice, and we don't need to get into it, under the circumstances, given the leaks, given the problems in Abu Ghraib, which I firmly believe have nothing to do with this policy, it is incumbent upon the executive to come forward and explain in a cogent way what we've done and how. But at the same time, it's incumbent upon us who are involved in public debate not to overreach, not to exaggerate, and not to overstate, and to look at the totality of a record. Let me just say briefly, yes, we had horrible abuses in Abu Ghraib. But on the other hand, and we also have 18 or 20 investigations involving some suspicious mm-hmm. deaths. Mm-hmm. Regrettably, unfortunately, those things happen in every war. Just one simple historical example. In the Korean War, we had fewer than 8,000 POWs in North Korean camps. Do you know how many people of our POWs died from torture, starvation, hunger, disease, malnutrition? Almost 3,000.
But we're not talking about a relative morality here. We're talking about law. We have to take a short break. David Rifkin, Walter Dellinger, stand by. Reed Brody, thanks so much for being with us tonight. I know we have to let you go, and we know where you see responsibility lying. Thanks for being with
us. You're quite welcome.
Reed Brody, special counsel with Human Rights Watch. We're talking tonight about torture in the war on terror and a White House accused of putting itself above the law. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join us, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about torture in the war on terror and a White House accused of putting itself above the law. My guest tonight, joining us from Washington, Walter Dellinger, professor at Duke University Law School, acting Solicitor General, 96-97, head of the Office of Legal Counsel, cited in the memos last week, from 1993 to 1996. He's currently head of the appellate practice at O'Milvaney and Myers. Joining us from Falls Church, Virginia, David Rifkin, partner at Baker and Hostetler. Rifkin served in the White House Counsel's Office and at the Department of Justice and Energy under Reagan and George H.W. Bush. You can join the conversation tonight when you read the memos seeming endorsement in extremis of even perhaps torture. How high up the chain of command do you feel responsibility lies here? Responsibility for Abu Ghraib, for that matter. Do you want the president to do whatever it takes or to follow the law, change the law if necessary, but follow it? Are soldiers on the ground taking the heat for decisions essentially made at the highest level of the U.S. government? Is any American, even the president, above the law? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Walter Dellinger and David Rifkin, I want to ask you each about the issue of constitutional role here and whether or not we have some elements of constitutional crisis in the exchange that we saw last week between Attorney General John Ashcroft in Congress and maybe in the president's stance. Let's listen to just a little bit of tape from John Ashcroft testifying before a committee last week. In this clip, Senator Ted Kennedy asks Ashcroft to hand over the Justice and Defense Department memos on interrogation tactics to the committee.
Those are three memoranda. Will you provide those to the committee?
No, I will not.
Under what basis?
On the basis that the longstanding established reasons for providing opinions provided to the executive branch.
General, the executive privilege is not a legitimate basis of withholding memoranda from this committee.
Senator Ted Kennedy, Attorney General John Ashcroft, Walter Dellinger, you're the attorney here. Whether in this exchange or the exchanges like this, there were more last week, or in the president's position, kind of ambiguous position on the law that you described, do we have a constitutional crisis here or not, in your view?
I don't think so. I think these are going to be resolved. The Washington Post is and some government heroic whistleblower or abject
blowers,
leaker
yep.
Has solved the problem by releasing the memo for Attorney General Ashcroft in spite of his wishes. I'm generally reasonably sympathetic to the notion that within the executive branch, you've got to have your own internal legal advice, just as Supreme Court justices get confidential memoranda from their law clerks and senators from their staffs. And
but if the government, even perhaps the president, appears to be breaking the law, not to everyone, debate, but if that appears to be the case and Congress can't ask for confirmation.
Let me tell you whether I think there is one, not a constitutional crisis,
okay,
but a fairly serious conflict over the respective constitutional authority, and that is the president's the assertion in the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum that the torture criminal statute may not apply to activities authorized by the president. Now, we have often opined under various administrations of various parties that some statutes simply do not apply to the president. But this is a statute that seems to be directed at sort of wartime activities undertaken by the government. So it Congress and the presidents who signed this into law seem to have made a considered judgment that it applies to the president. And the assertion that the president can declare himself not bound by that kind of law seems to be more in the keeping of Nixon's, President Nixon saying if the president does it, it's got to be lawful and contrary to President Harry Truman's decision to give back the steel mills when the court ruled otherwise, particularly since there seems to be an ultimate catch-22. Even if the president is wrong in asserting that he has the power to disregard this act of Congress, anybody who follows his advice further down the line is therefore immune from penalties. That really does make this activity, if you were to take that for the most it could mean, sort of beyond the reach of Congress.
And David Rifkin, your view, are we back into the Nixonian interpretation here? If the president does it or says it, it's lawful?
Not at all. And let's separate the two issues which you've done in your question. One is providing memos to Congress, and the second, the substance of advice. Providing memos to Congress, with all due respect to the members of that committee, the issues are not in order for Congress as a body, as an institution, as a coordinate political branch, to request information, it has to act in a certain proper way. An individual member cannot ask an attorney general for anything. I mean, to the extent they do, it's a matter of courtesy. So at the very least, they need to convince Orrin Hatch, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, to issue a request for it. That has not happened here. If a request is issued, it is indeed true that the executive privilege can only be invoked by the president.
And it's public anyway, so let's set that aside. What about, then, the substantial issue?
On the substantive issues, look, these are very difficult questions. And again, probably not all of your listeners, but some can profit by reading this memo. The memo doesn't say that Congress can never pass a statute that regulates the president's ability to use certain interrogation techniques in time of war. It says, as I read it, that this particular statute arguably doesn't get there. It's a very tough argument, but let me just set a very simple paradigm here. The person's powers, commander-in-chief, is at its strongest. We're really talking about a battlefield situation. We're talking about him deciding whether to send a given squad of soldiers to the left of a right to take a given hill,
yes,
whether or not a surgeon that was a part of a squad, what that surgeon can do to a given enemy combatant they capture. The further away in time and space you move from a battlefield, in my opinion, the more difficult it is becomes to argue that president's plenary power trumps everything Congress does. With all due respect to that statute, which really implements the anti-torture convention,
yes,
it does not incorporate these fine distinctions.
You mean battlefield distinctions that might come out of a battlefield situation?
The battlefield, this does not take care of Abu Ghraib, does not even take care of Guantanamo.
Yeah, yeah.
But if Congress, for example, passed a statute which said, and we can all agree with it, I'm sure Walt will agree with it, you cannot attack from the right. You always have to go in the left flank of enemy. It would be absurd. It would trench upon President's powers, commander-in-chief.
But torture is of a different nature than a left-right decision on a battlefield, isn't it?
Well, when I say left-right, I mean,
of course, I know what you mean. You mean tactic. You mean actually the direction of approach.
Interrogation of captured, killing the enemy and capturing the enemy, two flip sides of combat, just as much as dropping bombs from an airplane or using machine guns. My point is this: if Congress passes a statute, and Congress has power to regulate the conduct of a government, which says, for example, on a battlefield, if you capture prisoners, instead of asking them any questions, you should, put flowers in them and send them back, we can all agree that that would not only be foolish, it would be unconstitutional, right?
And it's far from what we're facing here.
I'm trying to explain to you that there are a lot of complex issues that the anti-torture statute on its face does not even try to resolve. So I would not go as far as the OC memo, which basically says Congress cannot do it, period. I would submit to you that that statute probably goes too far. And their only point was that if a statute goes too far, perhaps we should conclude that Congress really did not intend to reach the president's power at all.
And maybe that's the point, but we've got abuse on our hands and evidence of it. I want to invite our callers in. A lot of them have been waiting. Greg is calling from New Hampshire, from Brookline, New Hampshire. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, great show you have, always.
Thanks, Greg.
Hey, I just wanted to bring it in from a soldier's perspective. You've got all these legal guys talking here, but those soldiers that we saw in the Abu Ghraib pictures were flaunting the fact that they could treat these detainees as animals.
Smiling for the camera and all that. What do you take from that, Greg?
To me, that's a lack of humanity on their part, and it's a lack of the leadership saying, hey, what is going on here? You know, the leadership should have known better. And there are examples, you can read them on the web, of how many of these folks were fraternizing with each other, which is illegal in the Army.
But do you see that as a unit out of control in this horrible prison on the outskirts of Baghdad? Or do you see it related to these high-flown memos that were circulating in Washington?
No,
any connection?
What I see is the president saying, using torture in certain circumstances, and like the telephone game, it trickled down and it got worse and worse as people went along, misinterpreting what the intent from the very beginning. One of your speakers earlier mentioned, let's not overblow what the president can affect here or what he said. As it trickled down, these guys are living in conditions where they don't have regular showering, they're not eating the best of meals,
yep.
And they're starting to live like animals themselves. And it's very easy, having been in that situation before, being out in battle, that you start to become an animal yourself.
You need a very clear signal from the top. Greg, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. I want to get some more calls in because so many are waiting.
2 seconds observation. Do you really think that the people in Abu Ghraib knew about the memo from Office of Legal Counsel or report from Department of Defense, which were highly classified? Of course not.
Clearly they don't, but I think what our former soldier's saying here is that a tone gets set, and a tone can travel. But let's hear from some more callers. Cullen's calling from Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Cullen. You're on the air.
Yes. You know, all this legalism, it's all fine and good. And it may well be that at the end of the day, the president has some justification for these memos, and maybe the torture is all right under a technicality of the law. Hmm. But a part of this war, unlike any other war, a big part of this war, is supposed to be winning the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people and of others in the Middle East and beyond, around the world, persuading them that we have limited objectives, that we are humane, mm-hmm. that we believe in truth, justice, and the American way. Those people, that shopkeeper in Baghdad, is not sitting down nitpicking the fine points of the American code of justice.
He sees the photograph from Abu Ghraib. He sees the president saying we're acting within the law.
That's what he says, and that's what he hears.
And there goes the conclusion. Colin, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Ray is calling from Manhattan. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to make a point, which is a little similar to what the last two callers suggested, that Susan Sontag suggested. And it went something like this. When hunters kill big game, they hold it up with great pride so the public and their peers can see it.
The trophy.
The trophy, as a trophy. Now, they do that because it's sanctioned. It's the whole community around them appreciates that finding, that kill.
They'll be lauded for bagging the big one there.
And now, I do not believe that soldiers on the ground would have posed. Now, they may have done it secretly or out of anger or out of desperation, but they wouldn't have done it with pride if it were not sanctioned more generally.
But Ray, be fair. Maybe their audience they weren't thinking of the White House at all. Maybe they were thinking of somebody back home, somebody in another camp who was hot and dirty.
It's hard to believe that back home people, parents would appreciate the vulgarity.
That's true.
Of that
Forgive
kind
me,
of
not
thing.
If I may just say that.
Ray, thanks very much for your call. David Rifkin.
Yes, not the parents. Unfortunately, we live in a culture where certain members of society do extol and glorify that kind of stuff. In my neighborhood, a few weeks ago, we had an instance where several gang members hacked to death with machetes members of our gang. How did the police catch them? Because they videotaped this stuff. And the age of reality shows this is what people do.
But why do you point there instead of the Office of Legal Counsel that says there are circumstances where cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of prisoners may be fine, even torture? Why point to a gang and their video camera?
First of all, these people were not aware of the members of the Office of Legal Counsel, number one. Number two, newspaper stories describe the background of some of those people were sadistic thugs. One of the major protagonists beat up his wife, slipped razor blades in the food he is
so you lay it back on them, and we hear that. But our time is short. Walter Dellinger, if you would, where do you think we need to go from here in this whole mess?
I think, assuming that the Rifkin point is well taken, that nobody saw these memos who did Abu Ghraib. But my concern is going forward with the memo out saying cruel, inhumane, degrading treatments are legal, and the president saying no one needs to worry, we're following the law, and what kind of message that goes when it's communicated throughout the world on BBC, Armed Forces Radio, whatever else. That's the concern going forward. The president has to step up and say more than we're following the law now that we know what the law is, because I'm afraid that it will have the effect going forward that it is unlikely to have had so far, because those memos have been secret.
There they are, and they're there to be read, and there's a call for, at the very least, a clarification. I want to thank you both for your thorough conversation with us tonight. David Rifkin, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
David Rifkin, former White House attorney in the White House Counsel's office, and Walter Dellinger, thank you very much for joining
thank
us
you,
tonight.
Sir.
Walter Dellinger, head of the appellate practice at O'Melveny & Myers, professor at Duke University Law School. He was head of the Office of Legal Counsel from 1993 to 1996. You can continue this conversation, listeners, online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.